As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Paul Sweeney. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen, and always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
Joining us now, the one that puts Greek and Latin into our bond coverage, Robert Michael, Bob Michael of J.P. Morgan. How do the Greeks right now, the derivative Greeks, play into what you do? When you look at the quiet of holes in the market or a new volatility, maybe it's skew that you play into, how does a derivative space fit in?
They're critical to what we do in the markets. I think so much of what you try to do is in the cash market. But there's limited bandwidth. Broker-dealer balance sheets aren't what they used to be.
Right.
And a lot of the balance sheet in the industry sits with investors like ourselves. And we tend to own securities until we change our mind. So we're not in the market actively trying to change positions. You go into the derivatives market to help you change the positioning of your portfolio or perhaps put a bit of a hedge on.
Is there a Bob Michael, and I think of Ian Lingan at BMO Capital, you're saying we're going to see price up, yield down. Is there a bet in the space now, like what you believe, that we will see as a regime lower yields?
Well, it's everywhere. We liken the current environment to 1995. There's one critical difference. When the Fed finished hiking rates from 3% to 6% in 95, the entire yield curve was above the Fed funds rate. Today, we think the Fed is done hiking rates, but the entire yield curve is trading roughly 100 basis points through the Fed funds rate. So that's telling us that the market still believes that the Fed will come in, take pressure off of businesses and households by doing at least a few rate cuts over the next 12 months.
Bob, we're sitting here with the two-year Treasury almost at 5% here. I don't know. I'm going to park my money right there, and I'm going to feel fine. Is that a bad trade?
It's not a bad trade, but you may feel lonely compared to the money that's sitting in money market funds. You're willing to step out, but what we're looking at is over $6 trillion of assets sitting in money market funds, and they're feeling cozier at somewhere closer to a 5.5% yield. For that money to come out and come into the bond market, we do need to see the Fed begin to cut rates, or at least telegraph that they're thinking about it again and not dropping these hints that maybe rates could go higher.
So what do you think our Fed should do? I mean, the economic data suggests that maybe there's no reason to cut rates. We've got, I don't know, inflation's still out there.
If I were at the Fed, everything looks so good, I would just sit on my hands for the next couple quarters, see what happens into the election, and do nothing. You're looking at over 2 years of unemployment below 4%. Yep. I know we get PCE at the end of this week. There's a lot of debate. Is it going to be 2.7 or 2.8 year over year? Is it a 0.25 or 0.27 increase? The reality is 2 something year over year is much lower than the 6.6% year over year it was a couple years ago.
Is a stated system, is there leverage in the system? Is there that animal, I don't want to say animal spirit, that ancient animal instinct to leverage up when we're certain we know what we're doing. Is there that bet right now?
You're not seeing it to the extent that we saw it previously, either headed into the dot-com bubble in 2000 or certainly into the great financial crisis in 2007, 2008. But there is a lot of borrowing going on out there. The most levered balance sheet are not businesses and household, they're actually federal governments globally. Mm. When you look about the extension of credit right. into the system, bank balance sheets may have shrunk, but private okay. credit is out there.
But the heart of the matter, going back to Rogoff and Reinhardt, this time is different, is they took within their iconic study of debt that it's about public and private combination of debt. Would you suggest we're going to see a private debt issuance and build up in belief in debt? So we've got both public and private over indebtedness.
It doesn't feel like we're heading there.
I agree.
Right, yeah. right now, it feels like, and I know you did a story that consumers are looking to do a bit more vacationing, and a third of them are willing to put that, willing to go on into debt to do that. Going into the financial crisis, 120% of them would have been willing to have gone into debt to go on vacation. So there is some moderation. You look at housing, consumers aren't changing,
right.
aren't chasing housing prices higher.
Well, let's listen to our Latin tour guide
okay.
here as we go to Rome.
Greek? Arma virumque cano troiae qui primus aboris.
That's great. Yeah. And that's like Lisa Mateo scheduled to go to Rome here. She's going deep into debt
okay.
to go to loans so she can catch nice. Up with Bob Michael on the Latin that's
perfect.
That's out there as well. It's going to happen.
Bob, what do I do here? And if I want to take some credit risk here, do I stay with investment grade? Do I go to high yield? Because high yield was the performer last year in the fixed income space. Where do I go in a credit space?
You hope that over the next week, high yield pulls back a little bit further, and then you go in.
You go
without up, yeah. recession on the horizon, you have nothing to fear but yourself if you stay out of the high yield market. You're picking up now yields of over 8%.
Wow.
Corporate profitability looks good. It's a much cleaner high yield market than anything in my lifetime. Yeah. 6% of it washed away back in 2020.
I guess I got to go to the Fed meeting as well. The basic idea is it's a snooze fest to get to June when they redo the dots. And there's a raging debate now, Paul Craig Torres with great leadership on this over the weekend, about the Fed almost over-communicating. Is your world made more complex because there's too much communication from Fed presidents, governors, and leaders?
You know, Tom, the one dead language that I miss is Fed speak. Remember in the days back in the 80s when the Fed wasn't always telling yep. you every day what you were thinking?
I yearn for it.
You used to get the Fed minutes. You used to get listen to the Humphrey Hawkins testimony. You heard what Greenspan said. Then you got out your secret Fed decoder ring and interpolated
right,
what he meant. And there was a value to that. And I think there is just way too much daily information coming.
Paul,
from
the most important conversation I've had on this is someone that Bob Michael knows, Richard Berner, who drove the ship at Morgan Stanley for Steve Roach for years in the U.S. economy, public service to the nation at Treasury. And what's so important here is there was just what Mr. Michael says, and then you would go see a president at a Rotary Club or some other economic club, and they'd say just as little at the breakfast as they were saying to us on the street.
Bob, you're head of the Global Fixed Income, Currency, and Commodities Group here. Let's go currencies. Is there a bear case for the U.S. dollar here, or are we just all long the U.S. dollar and letting everybody else deal with it?
There's a bear case for the dollar when the Fed starts cutting rates. Until they do that, there's no sense fighting the strength in the dollar. If you look at when the dollar really started to gain strength, it's when the Fed started hiking the Fed funds rate at the start of 2022. Back then, yen was about 110. not 150. The entire strength in dollar yen has come from the Fed hiking rates, not anything that's happened on the Bank of Japan's part.
So, and we see central banks around the world cutting rates or saying they will cut rates, signaling that they will cut rates. So, I mean, how does the Fed think about the dollar when they think about their rate policy?
You're right. There have been 7,000 basis points of rate cuts in the emerging market central banks. So those central banks have been cutting rates for over a year. And I have to imagine they're starting to second guess whether they need to keep cutting rates here. I don't know that the Fed thinks about the dollar all that much. If we go back, we were just talking about the Fed speak of the 1980s. I remember we used to look at the TAN book, we used to look at the minutes, we used to see how they prioritized inflation, growth, and the dollar. And many times, the dollar was their number one priority. I don't think it's their priority right now. I think it's a huge one for the ECB and the Bank of Japan.
Bob, in the time we've got left, I really want to focus here on end of the earnings season and corporate issuance. Off of like Zvi Bodhi at Boston University, or there's a thing folks called M&M. It's not the candy, but it's a theory here on the allocation of your capital structure to debt. Are we under-debted right now in quality corporate America? Do they have not enough bills, notes, and bonds?
I think we are. We have spent the last quarter trying to poke holes in corporate profitability in the market and at JP Morgan with our credit research team, and they can't do it. And instead, what they're seeing is a reacceleration in corporate profitability and businesses thinking about investing in CapEx again. It looks pretty bright out there for corporate America. It does remind me of 1995.
Do you suggest bond issuance will be the surprise of the next 18 months?
I don't know. I think there's a shortage of corporate debt right now. We were looking out over the next couple quarters, and there's more money maturing than there are planned issuance.
What you just heard there, folks, is classic John Templeton from Bob Michael. I'm sorry, Paul. I'm in this camp. There's a shortage of bonds. Nobody's looking at the Bob Michael world, and it's a tangible part of how we do this, and it links into the equity market, and there's just a shortage of bonds. That's all there is to it.
I mean, Bob, you're JP Morgan Asset Management. You guys are pretty big. If you wanted to get out of a position, change a big allocation, is there enough liquidity on the street to kind of get that trade done to your liking today versus 10 or 15 years ago? How much harder is it, if at all, to kind of make major trades for you guys?
Right now, when things are relatively stable, you can do it. It will take a little bit of time, depending how large a position you're trying to move. There's a lot more in portfolio trading, so hundreds of line items all at once at a single price. That's a feature that didn't exist pre-financial crisis. But when everyone is worried and everyone's pulling back liquidity and their balance sheet, then it is far more challenging than it was pre-financial.
But you're JP Morgan. You say, get that trade done for me, right? I mean, you guys are the players.
You try not to do that.
You are
reliant on a counterparty. I think that's a pre-financial crisis
attitude.
Let me pin down the 10-year yield 12 months from now, just a vanilla media call here for animals like me.
I think we're going to be right around 4%.
Down, but not down with the drama that financial media demands.
Not a whole lot. Not a whole lot. I think the Fed could probably get 125 basis points of rate cuts.
So are you doing cliff notes now on Fed speak? If you got Greek and Latin down from your undergraduate days, looking at Fed speak?
I don't need to do it. They're telling us every 10 minutes what they're thinking. You don't need cliff notes.
Bob Michael, thank you so much. Just generous with his time here on a Monday morning. He, of course, is with JP Morgan.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
This is what we like to do best. There's no other way to put it. We like to look at equities, bonds, currencies, commodities, and shift from world class to world class. We do this with Bob Michael of JP Morgan and Bonds. And now one of my favorite people looking at, it's called investment strategy, but far more, it's just equity strategy. Liz Young joins us with an always twisted view from SoFi. Thrilled she could be with us today. Liz, into this earnings season, is a glass half full or less so?
You know what? I think it's half full on expectations, but companies have to come through. And I have to tell you, Tom, I don't think I've ever been called twisted on a Monday morning. So I don't know if that's a good sign for the week. But I think what's going to happen this earnings season, we've already seen it a little bit, especially with the financials, is that it's not just about the results. It's always about the guidance. But I think right now, even more so, especially right. with where equity valuations are, companies have to come in with guidance, and expectors are expecting the guidance to be stronger even than before. So companies have to come in with strong guidance and optimistic outlook in order to really be rewarded at these levels.
Yeah, but the reason I say twisted, folks, is I got SoFi working off of Anthony Noto with a real digital heritage. It's almost like a West Coast ethos here on like three zip codes in Midtown Manhattan. And Liz, with that, how does a technology group look? I mean, maybe not individual stock, if you don't want to give me a buy, hold, sell on Apple, although we're listening. But the basic idea here, does the tech boom continue?
I think there's two things that we need to pay attention to in these results for tech companies. First and foremost, investors should be aware that expectations for S&P earnings growth are positive, marginally, right? Low single digits. And all of that growth is coming from those tech companies, or the expectations are coming from those tech companies. So we need tech to come through on these first quarter results in a positive way in order to carry the index.
This is
the other thing that I think is happening, and that is really important to watch, not just this quarter, but for the rest of the year, is that we obviously had all of this AI enthusiasm pull forward. And now we're looking at it through a company lens of, when is it really going to come to fruition? When is it going to actually create profits? And I think some of the enthusiasm and excitement is coming out of that, just as everybody realizes that the profits aren't happening immediately. And there's only really a couple companies that are doing a decent job of generating revenue off of AI right now. So it may just take longer. Doesn't mean the theme is dead, but it may just take longer in order to justify these levels of valuations.
All right, let's talk about valuations. Liz, give us your thoughts about how this market is valued here. Do I pull out the Magnificent Seven and try to look at the market on that basis? Where are we?
Well, given where yields have gone just over the past month, the market right now is valued for a pretty great environment. And when I say pretty great, I mean, we've got fundamentals from an earnings perspective that need to deliver, at least stay this strong or strengthen. And we would also need the economic fundamentals to stay this strong or strengthen. And we would need geopolitical risks to calm down, or at least have the absence of any big shocks. In the last couple of weeks, we obviously have had geopolitical tensions heating up and the likelihood of shocks feeling higher. So the valuations as we see it now, especially given where 10-year yields are, do feel a bit high, even with this recent pullback. So I think we have to really watch how these numbers deliver, how the data delivers. And we've obviously got a big inflation read coming later this week.
Yeah, we do, absolutely, on Friday. And Liz, that kind of goes to, I guess, the Fed. I mean, the market seems to be pricing out, you know, much fewer rate cuts this year. How much is the market being held hostage by rate cuts, or the expectation of rate cuts at the moment?
I think the momentum in the market is absolutely held hostage by what the expectations for rate cuts are. So far, we've digested it pretty well. I know that there's been a correction. It's only a little bit so far. It just feels bigger because our muscle memory is for the market to rise uninhibited. But I think the rate cut mentality is starting to actually affect where markets are trading, but that's more of a rational approach. Some of the relationships that we typically expect from markets, things like yields up, stocks down, that is actually happening again, which feels much more rational to me. And I think investors are taking a hard look at how much am I really willing to pay for forward earnings in an environment where yields may stay high, if not higher, for even longer than we expected.
Bob Michael was there. He's looking for lower rates, but Liz, not much lower rates. There's not much drama from JP Morgan. Price up, yield down. Yeah, we get that. If we get, as you say, higher yields or a new regime, a higher yield reset or an R-starred to take it over to economics of 2.5, 2.6, dare I say 3.1%, how does that fold into the stock market 3 years out?
Well, I think that's what we're going through right now is this digestion process of, okay, if yields aren't going to come down as dramatically as we thought by the end of this year, when will they come down? Now, what we're looking at is the reason that they're staying higher right now is mostly predicated on the idea that the economy is still strong, which has caused inflation to be perhaps more of a problem for a longer period of time than we'd hoped. So what companies have to do and what stocks will have to react to is that we probably can no longer pass through these inflationary pressures because we've done that already. And there's not a lot of clearance to do much more of it. So companies are going to have to be careful about costs. They're probably going to engage in some cost cutting in order to maintain margins and then get more creative and get more intentional about how they're going to expand their own pie. How are they going to grow revenue without having to pass through costs? And I think that's where we're going to start to see a lot of divergence in these groups that have just blindly benefited from some inflationary rises in revenue.
All right, Liz, what are some sectors that you think, or maybe that you guys are looking at right now going forward for the back half of the year?
Well, there's obviously been a rotation that's been on and then the rotation's been off. And I think we're going to continue to see some of that volatility as the year progresses. Some sectors that I think will stay durable in those rotations, though, are energy. There has been a huge run in energy since the beginning of the year. So it could stall out a little bit as volatility picks up. And obviously, geopolitical tensions will affect that. But energy stocks still seem to be quite attractive to investors. And I think people are not quite positioned yet for those to look all that overbought. And then when you look at things like earlier in the year, I was constructive on healthcare. As we near an election, I would pare back on healthcare. I still do feel good about dividend paying stocks. Those can come from a number of sectors, but dividend payers in an environment where if yields do come down at some point, you want to have that in the portfolio.
When you're talking Anthony Noto, at SoFi, with all of his great work on Wall Street, I'm fascinated. Do we need to see tech pay a dividend, Liz Young? This whole idea, we're not going to do a dividend, it's a taxable event. We're only going to do share buybacks. Where are you on that?
Well, dividends are an important piece as a shareholder when you talk about shareholder-friendly companies. But if you're looking, you have to break tech up into a number of different pieces. There are tech companies that have been around for a really long time, very established, maybe in more saturated markets, and the growth is slower because they're not innovating at such a fast clip and they're very large companies. Whereas if you look at smaller companies that are still growing very, very quickly, what you want to hear from those companies as a shareholder is that they're investing in their growth. So I don't think we can paint it with a broad brush. Company like SoFi, smaller, earlier in its life cycle than maybe something really big like IBM that's been around for a long time. So as a shareholder, if you're buying a company with the intention to expect strong growth from it in the future, I'd probably want to hear that they're investing in their growth.
Liz, thank you. Just wonderful. Liz Young, thank you so much. Head of Investment Strategy at SoFi, and I really can't say enough about Bob Michael to Liz Young, excellence there in bonds and in equities. Joining us now for a brief in the Philadelphia 76ers, Eric Belchunas. How revved up is Philadelphia?
Oh, we're revved up. We enjoyed the, I had my first beer moment when the New York Knicks fan just going up 1-0 in a best of seven were like burning Embiid's jersey, all these chants. They acted like they won this championship. That was fun. It should be interesting in Philly. We like to return the favor.
Yes.
What's the single thing that can allow the Sixers to do better than the pundits say?
Play more Kyle Lowry, who is just an animal in the clutch, and play less Tobias Harris, who is way... Philly is just over this guy, but he's like... Just assumed he's a starter. He plays a lot. He just misses a lot of shots.
It all comes down to Embiid.
Does.
He's a warrior.
And Embiid, I think against the Knicks, he'll show clutch genes. Sometimes Embiid has this thing with the Celtics. He just can't beat them in the end, but I think he'll do good against the Knicks.
We had to do this. The only reason Balchunas would show up if we talk Sixers basketball. Yep. So Eric Balchunas owns a high ground in ETFs. I want to make clear, folks, this is an earned high ground. He didn't do it with PR people. He didn't do it with social media. He did it with two books that are absolutely mint. The Magic of John Bogle, and also, of course, this ETF boom that's there. I got to go to the event over the weekend. A manipulated halving of the supply of Bitcoin up today. Last time I looked, up $1,400, 66,000. What does that mean for the kajillion dollars in Bitcoin ETFs?
Yeah, right now it's a little bit of a holding pattern. The flows have been, you know, a little bit, a couple outflows here, a couple inflows there. But that second wave I spoke of the past couple weeks has definitely died down. We'll see if we get a third wave. So right now we're holding at about net $12.5 billion since they launched, which to me, if that's all they get this whole year, that's a success. That's how big that number is. But we'll see what happens. I think that the price is holding pattern is interestingly intertwined with the flows holding pattern. Maybe one of them is waiting to go up, but they tend to be in a spiral together for now. I think the ETFs are one of the biggest catalysts. There's definitely algos trading off of the ETF flows, so there's almost like an amplification effect. So we'll see what happens with the ETF flows this week. One good news, though, is GBTC's outflows continue to get lower. So they're now in the same double
digits.
That's
the Grayscale?
Yeah, the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust that converted with $28 billion. It's now down to, I think, $20 billion, but has seen $16 billion of outflows. That's been a weight on this, but the $12.5 billion is net of those outflows. But GBTC seeing less and less is a good sign. But the nine new ones have also seen less and less inflows. So we're kind of at this sort of, like I said, it's just sort of a breather. And that makes sense. You know, ETF flows for something like that would be hot sauce like this tend to be somewhat correlated with price. But there's some catalysts coming up. I think a large chunk of advisors haven't even looked at this yet. They like to wait a couple months. The wirehouses, they're not really able to solicit them yet. So, and you got no options on them yet. That could come down the road. So there's some good optimistic catalysts, but of course, Bitcoin's price can do crazy things, and that's a huge variable.
Is BlackRock just going to own this space too?
Yeah, I mean, I just tweeted today, they've now seen 69 straight days of inflows. Basically, right out of the gate, flows every day. That's basically in the top 10 all time. And it's the most highest streak of any ETF by far that's active right now. So they're loving it. I mean, Larry Fink was on a different channel about 2 weeks ago, and he was grinning ear to ear like a proud father about iBit. He's like, this is the greatest launch in ETF history. Now, keep in mind, BlackRock has 1,000 ETFs across the world. They've got a bunch of other businesses. He rarely brings up individual ETFs, and here he is talking about this one ticker, which, by the way, listen to this stat. Out of those 1,000 ETFs in the world, iBit accounts for 24% of all their net flows this year.
Wow. Well, you know, there's a generational thing going on here. Do you notice this, Paul? On the other side, Balchunas and Lisa, they're like incredibly cut and chiseled.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
You and I can barely keep in this. Your perspective on the death of the mutual fund business. Paul and I live this, each in our own way. When do they roll up and go home?
Yeah, this is a very complicated...
It's complicated.
It's complicated. In most businesses, if you lose customers, you probably get acquired or you got a business, like in a mall. If you sell candlesticks and the customer stops coming, it's over, right?
Right.
Maybe a month you have and then you're out. The thing with mutual funds is you can lose customers and still make more money if the market goes up. So you got all these mutual funds that came into this last bull market, we'll call since 2008.
Yeah.
They had trillions of dollars. So even though they've seen trillions of outflows, the market's gone up, what, three, fourfold? So the value of their portfolios is gigantic. So equity mutual funds, this stat will blow your mind. It makes my head hurt. have seen $3 trillion of outflows in the past 10 years. Right? Makes sense. That's the story.
Yeah.
But their assets grew by $6
trillion. Wow.
So just they're doing fine.
Yep.
But they're losing customers. It's a mirage asset. So, and they know this. So what I like to say is the writing's on the wall. They can see the writing on the wall. They know they're making as much money right. as ever, but they know the customers are leaving. So a lot of them are moving over to the ETF space to try to be where the customers are.
Are they successfully moving over to the ETF space?
Yes, but success means a little cannibalization. And some are more willing to do it than others.
Right.
JP Morgan's a great example. Got cheap quick and is having huge success. I think the more diversified a company is, like JP Morgan has so much going on.
They can do it.
Jamie Dimon might not even be aware of what they're doing. That those people hire an ETF person and they create a true ETF business. The tough ones are the mutual fund companies, like say a Federated or MFS, where all they have is the mutual funds. It's harder for them to eat their own arm off.
Yeah, get one more in here, Paul.
So, I mean, where, other than the Bitcoin space, where are we seeing fund flows these days? We just had Joanne Bianco on from the Bond Blocks. They're seeing flows and going into high yield and so on and so forth. Where are you seeing kind of the flows?
Yeah, let me give you a great example. So emerging markets. Emerging markets kind of been a little, you know, off lately.
Yep.
But there's one ETF that's taken in four times the flows of any other, and it's a non-obvious one, EMXC. This is the iShares Emerging Markets ex China.
Ah.
This thing is now $13 billion. You know, this is like I said, they grow up so fast sometimes. So if you have no China in your EM, your ETFs are flying off the shelves. If you have China in your EM ETF, you can't sell it.
Wow.
Thank you. This was great. And thank you for the 76ers brief.
Anytime.
I'm the rook. I don't like Lisa and I were like, we don't know what we're talking about. Sweeney's
Kyle Lowry. The more you see him, the higher our chances are.
Eric Belchunas, thank you so much. And the Philadelphia 76ers, they play a team in New York here.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Your daily look at the front pages. Lisa, all-nighter Sunday night, getting ready for the newspapers. What do you got?
I need another cup of coffee now. That's what I need. We're starting with the Wall Street Journal. They have this interesting look about how diversity goals, they're starting to disappear from companies' annual reports. So they did this analysis of 10K filings to the SEC. Now, some companies shortened descriptions, removed entire sections. Others changed a few words, phrases to cut out mentions of race-specific hiring. But, you know, it comes, you know, as a lot of legal, political threats after affirmative action decision. So these are some of the changes. Kohl's like no longer says it's cultivating, quote, diverse leaders. It now says it's just leaders. So those are just some of the things. But analysts are telling the Journal that there's this kind of reevaluation in the level of political risk that these companies are willing to take now. So now you're starting to see a difference from a few years
ago. And I would
say
the catalyst, Paul, for this was money. I think it started with Hollywood, where different Hollywood entities added up actual screen failures from somewhat of a diversity thrust led by Disney. And one number I saw in Variety was $1 billion of losses on projects that were spurred forward by diversity. And now it's come over to other industries.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen written in a variety of media over the last 6 months, kind of phrases of peak DEI, peak wokeness. Have we passed the peaks and those types of things? I don't know. But again, here's something from the Wall Street Journal talking about diversity in annual reports.
One thing they say, Lisa, is I had a shtick going years ago where I'd interview a CEO. Usually they don't want to come on with me because, I ask like real questions. And, I would put up their annual report from 3 or 5 years ago, which read like it was in Sanskrit, because there's always a vote. To be fair to everybody doing the hard work of diversity, there's always something in. And 2 or 3 years later, you look back and you go, did I really write that? Or did my team really write that? That's why one reason I think James Diamond's 62-page epistle is actually valuable, because he's not writing a PR structured MD&A, but it's fascinating to see where this is 12 months from now. So what else do you
have? Yeah, it keeps changing. Okay, this is about more Americans wanting to go on vacation, right? Vacation season, but they're willing to go in debt in order to go on vacation. This is a Bankrate survey. A little more than half say they're planning the summer vacation 2024, but of those, 1 in 3 say they are willing to go in debt. Put it on a credit card. Wow. They're willing to buy now, pay later, borrow from family, friends to go on vacation, even taking out personal loans in order to get that vacation.
There's a thing called Uplift, which is the buy now, pay later for airplane tickets. Mm-hmm. And that's changed the world.
Oh, game changer.
And what I see there is people that would fly economy doing that buy now, pay later and buying premium economy. Or people that would buy premium economy, buy now, pay later, slide into business class. And to me, that's been a profound... It's one vehicle of what you're talking about here.
Well, we've heard from all like the cruise companies that they're fully booked and they're booking into next year and bookings are great. And same thing for the hotels.
But let's get an update on it.
Rich, help me out here. This is important.
Where's he going?
Rich is our surveillance cruise reporter.
Oh, really?
He's been there's no cruise. He's even done the Alaska polar bear thing like with the
Abramowitz.
11 cruises. Are they booming? They're booming. Like you got a race to get a booking. Where's your next cruise, Rich?
Oh, gosh.
He's going to Yugoslavia. What? Dubrovnik. Can you see Rich? Folks, he's probably taking Ken Felio, our global technical director. Can you see Rich Sherman at the parapet of the Game of Thrones castle in Dubrovnik looking out, looking for the damn dragons? I can see it now.
He's at the buffet of the ship.
Yeah. Okay, so we've been talking about Apple relying on China and the iPhone for growth.
Big deal.
Yeah, so Apple, what Bloomberg is saying, this is a really interesting report, that they need to explore new ways to get back on track, like a lower grade iPhone, maybe in the $250 range. Don't know if that's possible, but the article really gets into how, different ways Apple can go about doing that. But it's really been trying. I mean, they've been trying to put out, all-in-one services, a lot of accessories. That hasn't worked. They tried to put out a cheaper iPhone. Didn't really pick up too much. But Bloomberg is saying this is that target. They need to hit that $250.
Well, I mean this is reporting by Mark Gurman, so nobody knows Apple better than Mark Gurman. But I've always kind of said, if they keep saying they point out India as a market for growth, given that maybe they want to pivot away from China. But if you want to be a player in India, don't you have to have a lower cost phone to appeal to that market?
Yet, can you make the profit Apple is addicted
to? You're right.
Yeah. I don't have in front of me those ratios, but the amount of money Apple makes per phone versus Samsung is shocking. It's a shocking delta.
You're right. They focus on
margin. You got
on
one more today?
I do. Okay, so more workers, or should I say some workers, they swear that ketamine, although there's psychedelics, can boost creativity and focus on the job. I mean, we saw it. Elon Musk says he takes it to boost his mental health. But the thing that's pushing is because it's becoming legal in some areas, like Oregon, Colorado. So it's lessening that negative feel that people have. Yes, ketamine and psychedelics.
We call that LSD in another time. You listen to Disraeli Gears and, not that I know anything about that.
But no, not, of course not. But the FDA says they say ketamine is not good for mental health treatment. Yeah, they don't recommend it.
Psychedelics are beginning to find some adherents beyond Silicon Valley who say the drugs make them better at their jobs by expanding imaginations or taming doubts about their abilities, though supporting research is limited. Go figure.
Yeah.
And this is from the Wall Street Journal.
So we'll see if it kind of picks up. But
ketamines.
More workers are kind of getting behind it and hopping on the train. We'll see.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you, Lisa. That was, you know, newspapers. Lisa Mateo with our newspapers.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast, bringing you the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen, and always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.